Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd. This is the Chuck Toddcast. So this past week has been a stream of partisan bickering, as if that's different from any other week. Debt ceiling negotiations, or lack thereof, on Capitol Hill. The debate over Supreme Court ethics with Clarence Thomas. And the state houses censuring dissenting voices in places like Montana and Tennessee. The question is, where in the world are the moderates? They exist, but does anybody want them involved? And for the few we can point to, like Romney and Sinema, are they here to stay? I'm joined now by author and journalist Robert Draper. He recently wrote a profile and actually appears to have gotten an actual time with Kyrsten Sinema, the elusive one. And he did this for the New York Times. Mr. Draper, it's good to see you.
Good to see you, Chuck.
You have a pretty good track record of getting iconoclastic people to talk. And I always think it's because you would have been one had you been as iconoclastic, right?
Who knows? Well, I mean, I've been accused of that before.
Yeah. I know you've been described that way. And I'm like, I don't know if he is. I've spent too much time with you to see.
I think it's more, though, Chuck, that because I'm a magazine writer, I can play a longer game. And took me about 8 months to get my first interview with Kyrsten Sinema. And most people don't have that time. And I just made the time to do it. And in the end, I got, you know, four interviews with her. Mm-hmm. And that's four more than most members of the national media have.
Why do you think she's so hesitant to talk?
Well, she thinks it's not worth her time. She thinks that talking only means that you get kind of funneled into the noise machine and you're misrepresented at every turn. She doesn't like to show her hand, her negotiating hand, so prefers to keep her cards close. But I also think she's been persuaded, Chuck, recently by friends of hers that strategy is not working for her. You know, and especially now that she's declared herself an independent, is likely to run for 2024 in a three-way race. Mm-hmm. She needs all the help she can get. And so explaining herself as opposed to waiting for someone else to fill the narrative void is probably the better way to go in her view.
Is she naturally shy, or do you think this is somebody who's been wounded by the national press, a la Hillary Clinton, and has a new veneer?
It's neither. I don't think that she feels wounded per se. I think she's seen over time that the media doesn't represent her faithfully, and that they tend to take a reductive view of her. But
her definition of the media? I always love, you know, when we always do this, it's like the media.
But it's also the Arizona media. I mean, she does. They're members of the Arizona press. She's had a decent relationship with, off and on, but more off than on. And so really, the media means pretty much everyone. I mean, she there is no friendly interviewer to whom she's gone over the years.
I'm friendly with somebody who frequently gets her to come on his talk show. He's a right-leaning guy, sort of a non-crazy R. You know, he's sort of an election believer, conservative. And she seems to always mind that politics. Like there are certain – she seems to almost mind her right of – I think the big beef with the left has with her, which I think is a bit irrational, is that she seems to mind her right of center politics more than she does her left, her progressive base.
Yeah, and we'll see if it comes back to bite her next year. I mean, it is true that she felt that she could count on Democratic faithful in 2018, but she conspicuously ran when she ran for Senate as an independent voice.
Well, my favorite comment was she did this, it was an NPR interview, debate, and they asked her if she was a proud Democrat, and she goes, "Proud? I guess I'm a Democrat." I mean, she was, it was an interesting moment. And I think a lot of what I can't figure out is she had a theory of the case that the only way to win is she had to be a regretful Democrat.
No, why
she went down that road, whether that was just her theory of the case or who she really is.
I don't think she was being coy or cute in that case, Chuck. I think that it's always been a somewhat uncomfortable fit. And I think it goes back to her time in the state legislature when she was more of a bomb thrower and couldn't get anything done. She always operated in the minority then when she moved over from sort of Green Party affiliation to Democrat. And she cozied up to Republicans to get done what she could. But no, I don't think that she's ever really felt that she's in alignment with any party. She's never going to caucus with Republicans. That's never going to happen. She's never going to switch over because she does.
Because they want her. I mean, right? Romney works her hard on this.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, she is she's an openly bisexual woman who is strongly pro-choice. There is no way that her social values align with those of the GOP, and those are important to her. She doesn't emphasize them in Arizona because they don't get her much votes, but they really are important to her. To the extent that she has a value system, that part is concrete.
I go back to this idea that she doesn't think somebody that's elected to public office doesn't think they ought to participate in the public square.
Yeah.
It is something that I don't like it. I'm not running.
You're talking about her reluctance to just even engage with voters. Yeah. Again, I mean, I think that in 2024, we're going to see her try to get by with the very minimum. But let's face it. I mean, how many senators hold town halls, really? You know, can you think of more than three?
But look at the difference between Manchin and Sinema.
Yeah.
It's night and day. They have the same positions.
Right.
It's night and day. Manchin explains himself. She doesn't.
Yeah.
Right. There's a perception that you're like, and so then what happens when you don't explain yourself, other people explain it for you. The left's convinced she does it for K-Street.
Yeah.
It's pretty obvious to me she doesn't act that way. She's, I think, come about this, how do you get stuff passed? This is how you get stuff passed. I think she's come about this honestly, but her lack of explaining herself does allow everybody else to fill in the blanks. And
it's,
I think
she's
allowed that.
It's a question of whether you accept the explanation, because she has given them. I mean, for example, on the on preserving the carried interest loophole, which was her precondition for signing on to what became the Inflation Reduction Act, she was insistent that in a rough economy, a state like Arizona that depends on real estate investment, depends in turn on the investments made by private equity, and that this was the only incentive that they had to investing in affordable housing. Now, I've talked to people about that. I think that that is an argument. It's a talking point argument, and it's easily dismantled. Mm-hmm. But she makes the argument. I mean, it's true that she's not voluble. She doesn't appear on your show the way Manchin does, and she doesn't appear on anybody's shows. But that doesn't mean that she hasn't given explanations. She's just not very loud and frequent about them.
I think the initial press coverage of her. This is why I wondered if she is a product of what I think happened to Hillary Clinton, where the collective frenzy that is the press sometimes comes across so unfair, you can never forgive them. And she, iconoclastic, however you want to describe her, the way our media works right now, when I say our, the collective, throw in social media, it has been brutal against her. I think ridiculously so. I think the left has been pretty nasty about her. Now, she hasn't done the little thing. She hasn't done her homework. But that's why I keep coming back to this. She just feels like somebody who had such a horrible experience, you know, seeing her clothes picked apart. Like, nobody would like that. And I think that generally her Democratic counterparts haven't felt any empathy on that.
Well, so two things. The first is that I agree with you to the extent that Democrats celebrated her election in 2018 and openly said, hey, she's showing Democrats a new way. You know, Beto O'Rourke didn't gain the kind of traction with his more progressive stance. Maybe this is the way to do it. And now she's essentially making good on the very kind of platform she ran on in 2018.
I was just going to say, she's doing exactly what she said she'd do.
And they penalized her for it. Now, but to the degree that she's wounded, I actually don't think you go to like 2019 to the present. I think you go all the way back to when she was a kid and grew up in Dufuniac Springs, Florida, in a place with living in a converted gas station. Mm-hmm. A really rough, upbringing, and basically said, I don't want any part of this life, and became from that moment onward a survivor. And she dallied later with progressive politics, but I really think that in the end, what people see in her is not the progressive who became a betrayer and became like a plaything for K Street. She's a survivor. She always has been, and you really kind of have to be as an Arizona Democrat, and particularly I would say so there's a good counter to that, right? The counter is, no, you can be Mark Kelly. Well, okay.
He was an astronaut. Yeah. I tell all my lefty friends who say, well, but Mark Kelly. I said, first of all, have you checked his position on the border? You won't like it any more than you like hers, but you've decided you like him. He had that astronaut, there are The only thing better than businessman is astronaut.
Right. Right. All of that's true. It's also true that Mark Kelly has not brought to fruition bipartisan bills like the infrastructure bill. No. He can't get Republicans over. He doesn't have to. Not all Democrats have to. But, I mean, he's a reliable Democratic vote. And she is, for the most part, 90% of the time, right? But she has also helped with the gun safety bill and with the infrastructure bill, to name a couple. She that are significant. And now she's working on with immigration. She's uniquely capable of bringing Republicans on board. There's no other Democrat who can make that claim.
I am shocked that her relationship with the White House with President Biden is so bad, because she's exactly the type of senator Biden believed he is.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes no sense to me unless staff has gotten in the way.
Well,
and I think staff's gotten in the way.
Exactly. So I think White House staff had said, you need to mind the progressive base. You cannot upset them. When it came to all the Build Back Better negotiations and whether to couple or decouple that from the infrastructure bill.
The White House caused her problems. Her problems with the progressive base is directly the White House, who threw her under the bus to protect their own progressive skin.
Well, and they also thought she would fold. And that was a gross miscalculation on their part, because she's a tough cookie. I mean, whatever else one will say about cinema, the notion that she's just doing this for attention, and once she's gotten her attention, she'll dwindle off into the sunset, is empirically
untrue. It's obviously a miscalculation because, look, she's gotten plenty of attention. It's not great attention. She doesn't seem to love the attention. At what point do you stop questioning the motive and just sort of accept her beliefs?
All right. That's right. Now, I mean, now comes the question of like how this will all fare next year. Right. I mean, and I do think that
she's in a bad spot.
She is. Now she has, to some, she has gotten out from under a fatally bad spot by avoiding a Democratic primary. Right.
She wouldn't have survived it. And I thought she could, but not the venom that the left and the cable news side and the social media left, when they fuse together, they've decided they don't want
it. It's interesting. I mean, people think, well, but Arizona Democrats, could they really be so progressive? Yes. The base of the Arizona Democratic Party is, like where I'm from, the Texas Democratic Party, is quite progressive. And yes, they were infuriated by her. So she avoided that fatal step. Now comes this, frankly, unprecedented run. I mean, no independent has ever won statewide in Arizona. And to do that, she has to get 20-25% of Democrats, 25-30% of Republicans, 65-70% of independents. All of that sounds, like throw numbers up in the air, doable, until you consider that, Biden won with, 9% of Republicans in 2020, but he had the overwhelming support of Democrats, which he can't count on. So exactly how she threads that needle is, there's a certain don't try this at home kids quality.
No, she's got to win more. She's got to win a majority of independents.
Right. Oh, yeah. No, that's
and yet, she's got to hope that she does get 20% of Democrats. And I don't know if she will.
Well, that's the thing. I would say the independent part is the easiest part.
Yeah.
And the second easiest may be getting 20-25% of Republicans, especially obviously she's running against Carrie Lake. But to pull 20-25% away from Ruben Gallego, how exactly do you do that unless they've got an oppo book on Gallego, to which I'm not privy?
I think he's not as bulletproof as the left thinks he is. I think
who is? I mean,
no, but he's got some. I mean, look, his personal life has been in public.
Yeah.
And the fact that his ex-wife's the mayor of Phoenix is awkward, to say the least.
He could lose a couple of percentage points because of that. But again, like, that will be her hardest thing for sure. And it's I don't know exactly what the methodology is by which she peels 20-25% away from him, as opposed to, say, 10%. And she will need 20%. She really will.
Yeah.
Unless somehow Carrie Lake so offends so many Republicans. And I think Katie Hobbs got 11% or something like that of Republicans, which was quite a feat against Carrie Lake. But then you have to double that, which would be a real feat.
Here's the greater takeaway that we had from your piece. And if you look at it right now, what moderate is popular in their own party? And the answer is, I can't think of a single moderate who's popular inside their own party.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's – well
– we live in such polarized times where I don't think a moderate is rewarded by the public. They're rewarded by leadership sometimes. Like McConnell can be thankful for them. Schumer can be thankful for them because they got elected in states that they normally don't get elected in. but the public doesn't love it.
Yeah, no, that's right. Well, when you come to like the infrastructure bill, I mean, that was a feat of moderate politics on both sides. The interesting thing, I think this got left on the cutting room floor with my story, was that that bill was nearly killed near the end when Chuck Schumer realized, holy crap, this could actually happen. This could come to pass. I want to write the bill. And all these Republicans basically said, if Schumer's office is writing this, we don't want any part of it. So, you know, that's so once again, this is, and of course, that didn't happen. Biden was thrilled by it. It was like the first big positive of Biden's agenda after he had been faltering for so long. And you're exactly right. I mean, they're more than happy to campaign on this. And, you know, Democrats and Republicans alike say they like this kind of stuff, but they do not reward at the ballot box moderates.
And yet, the Democratic Party can't get a governing majority if they don't figure out how to get behind moderate Democrats.
Sure.
I mean, it's just there's no way they can win in Ohio, Florida, Texas, Montana, places that are going to have to start to figure out how to win a Senate seat more often than not because of you know, our polarized climate, our political segregation. You know, the floor for Republicans in the Senate now continues to go up.
Yeah, no, that's right. But I think you're especially right when it comes to the Democrats that in the states that you just named, and you could probably add a few more to that list. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a recipe for Democrats. I mean, like Manchin, Tester. I mean, these guys are taking on a lot of water, being moderates and somehow winning in Republican states. We'll see if that holds true with Tester next year.
I'm a little skeptical.
But that they have stood there as long as they have is a pretty remarkable feat and provides a roadmap in places like Texas. But the Texas Democrats in the primaries simply won't hear of it. And, you know, so they keep waiting for a kind of demographic magic wand. And yet they've come to see that it's not as simple a proposition as that. The Latinos, for example, in Texas are not nearly as, you know, automatically progressive as they might have thought. So Democrats are clearly going to have to rethink the strategy if they're hoping. I mean, frankly, you and I both know this, Chuck, that the winning formula for both sides has been to wait for the other side to shoot themselves in the foot.
That's all it is.
Yeah.
Now, the whole left of the Democratic consultant community has gotten more liberal. You know, it used to be the consultants. It's funny. The consultants on the Democratic side are more liberal than their voters. The consultants on the Republican side are more liberal than their voters.
Yeah.
And in some ways, Republicans are better at figuring out how to talk to swing voters because they're consultants. Are still swing voters.
Right. No, that's right. But again, what they're able basically to fall back on is we're not them, you know,
usually works.
Yeah, no, that's right. Well, and Katie Hobbs is governor of Arizona because it worked against, you know.
She's also the third most unpopular governor in the country.
Yeah.
Because she has nobody elected her.
Right.
They just didn't elect the other woman.
Right. Exactly. But the fear of Carrie Lake brought out a lot of progressives, which by the way, is why Kyrsten Sinema was not asked to campaign with Katie Hobbs. She did not want to offend, you know, her base.
I'm going to pause there. We'll be right back after a quick break. We're talking about the disappearing center in today's America. Plus, we're going to dabble a little bit into Texas politics with Rob Draper, who is a longtime Texan. You're listening to the Chuck Toddcast from Meet the Press.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Need a cold coffee with a bold flavor? Dunkin' Cold K-Cup pods were specially crafted for cold coffee. Brew over ice straight out of the Keurig coffee maker for smooth, delicious Dunkin' taste you know and love. Find your next Dunkin' Cold coffee in the roasted coffee aisle.
You are a longtime Texan, and you have reported on and seen Texas Republican politics, so I want to take a few minutes to talk about Greg Abbott, because I'm obsessed with him in a way that others aren't, because we just sort of gloss over. You know, have you been surprised that he can't find traction in the presidential race because he desperately wants to run and he's not because he doesn't want to fall on his face?
Sure. We have seen the short answer is no. I'm not really surprised. He's never been that appealing a character on the stump or in any kind of, you know, larger than life.
In theory, he could be. He just doesn't.
Yeah,
I don't get it.
I grew up, I mean, I'm watching George W. Bush Ann Richards, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
no, George I mean, you've Bush, seen.
And then Rick Perry. And all of these folks were fairly charismatic, you know, they really, and Abbott lacks that. In fact, if anything, to me, it's impossible to view Abbott out of context with Ron DeSantis. It seems these two have, since the pandemic, been trying to do a game of electoral one-upsmanship.
It is. And it's like, and in weird way, Abbott's winning, but DeSantis has gotten, it all sticks to DeSantis. Like, right. Abbott's been doing this stuff before DeSantis. Oh, migrants, we're going to do that.
Right. You know? Well, and I mean, DeSantis has pushed, you know, the Florida where wokeness goes to die. It's a very clever little meme. And Abbott has failed to do that. And I actually think that in part that's really because Abbott is not, he's not as naturally pugilistic a figure as DeSantis.
Well, it's funny you say that. So I've been hearing that, you know, there's a lot of CHIPS money being handed around the states and Texas could become a big place to become the next great chip maker.
Right.
You know what these companies don't want to hear? This is where woke goes to die. Right. We're not going to have abortion laws that are going to be manageable for women and things like this.
Right.
And it is my understanding that Abbott is very aggressive. He's trying to get as much. He is like knocking on the door of the Commerce Department. Yeah, we're in. We want to grow business. And yet he's still pushing his culture war. At some point, this is going to come to a head in Texas. I've been waiting. You know, you can't – like this feels like a tension that like Texas's growth is being powered in some ways by a whole bunch of people who are culturally out of sync where the rural Texas
is. No, that's right. And we began seeing this under Governor Perry, that Perry was picking off lots of businesses from California and all had to do with taxation. But you're exactly right, Chuck, that it comes to a certain point where the workforce that is expected to migrate from states like California to Texas is a workforce that wants a quality of life that's out of step with what the Texas Republicans are pushing.
Elon Musk went back. He did not move Twitter. He went back and he admitted to a really good source on this, and I'll just leave it at that. He admitted it's because the best engineers didn't want to live in Texas.
Right. Yeah. Well, they wanted to live in Austin. They're willing to live in Austin, but you know, that in fact is another story for another day, a very uneasy fit between Austin and Elon Musk. I think that this is a collision course the Texas Republican Party is on, because they have been really the model for a pro-economic growth state for 20 years or something like that. But finally, you know, the value system of the workforce is catching up with them. And I don't see, but I also think that dispositionally, separate and apart from that, Abbott is not naturally the kind of warrior figure that DeSantis
is. Not a cult. It's funny. I feel it is. And this is what comes through to me. He's trying to be a culture warrior.
Yeah.
You can tell it doesn't come instinctually. Right. Look, to Dan Patrick, it's instinctual. Yeah.
The lieutenant governor.
Right. Yeah. It is interesting to
Ted Cruz. It is too, right?
Yeah.
And we saw, you know, they've beaten back Republicans who were not nearly the fighters that they were. It's, you know, Abbott has had to do this, and Abbott is he's a fairly popular governor in Texas. You know, that's amongst Republicans.
Well, it's like he feels like a do no harm kind of guy to them. Like he's like, right. Well, he's good enough.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, and it's really, really hard to challenge a sitting governor who has his makeup from the right. You know, and I don't think it's going to happen. But to your original thought on all this, in a presidential sweepstakes, I don't see any room for Greg Abbott. I mean, he's not even Scott Walker. I mean, Scott Walker was, you know, a resume in search of an actual candidate, and Abbott is even less of a candidate. You know,
I completely agree. I think he has no future here whatsoever. And yet, shouldn't he?
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of one of those, he's got a lot of big donors that you would think in theory would be willing to fund him.
Sure.
And the fact that he doesn't have them, like,
right.
Or maybe he, you know, I'm sure he could find one. Like Tim Scott's got a donor who's going to like keep him alive. I'm sure he can find a Foster Freeze. Maybe he doesn't want to be that reliant.
It's interesting as we're talking about that, I'm starting to think that where you used to think of the state of Texas as a place that would be a launching pad for a governor, and that was the case, you know, for president, and that was the case with Bush, and seemed for a moment in time to be with Perry. It now seems to be a case where Abbott basically defeats Democratic hopefuls. You know, first Wendy Davis, and then Beto O'Rourke, and so that's I think that, you know, maybe that's the thing that'll be put on his tombstone.
It could be. Colin Allred, Ted Cruz. Why do I think this should be a race that is going to be closer than the experts?
Because Colin Allred's a really, really good politician.
Yeah,
I mean, he's very good.
Right, and the right recruit.
In 2018, you know, that was a more difficult race to win, and a lot of people figured that he would not. And he's a likable person. He's a canny
Dallas area
individual.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's that to me. is the best place to be from these days, right? Is in the North Texas?
Well, because it's also
where all the new population is.
That's right. Yeah. And by new population, what you mean are not just people who are moving in, but people who don't look like, you know, the way Texas looked like 30 years ago.
Dallas looks like North Texas feels like Phoenix now. Yeah. Feels like it's its own version of Maricopa County.
Right. Except there are a lot more people, say, from Asia that are moving there. Yeah. A lot of Indians, a lot of Sri Lankans, and so with that has really come a demographic shakeup, and the good old boy system that seemed to be endemic to the mm-hmm. Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex just is not in force there anymore.
The one thing that I openly was wondering about, Ted Cruz strikes me as somebody that might be vulnerable to a primary challenge if he wasn't careful. He's been awfully lazy this term.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, yeah, look, he tends to have good people around him. He tends to know, you know, that what needs to be done. But I do not think.
But what's he been doing other than podcasting? The first term, he was very involved in a lot of stuff.
Yeah, then came Trump, and I think that somehow, you know, his primary defeat to Trump, he seemed like a lesser character on the stage ever since then. You
know? He doesn't know what to do next. Because if the whole goal was to get there,
right.
And now he, I think, knows I ain't ever getting to the White House.
Right.
He doesn't know what he wants to be.
Yeah.
He probably thought, well, I guess I could have done Supreme Court, but I messed that up.
Yeah.
Right. Like he does seem like a guy who entered a midlife crisis a little bit earlier than most of us do.
He's a Club for Growth guy too. He represents that faction much more than the sort of, you know, populist nationalism.
Or did he just like, look, there's a whole group of Republicans that came of age when he came of age in the late 90s, early aughts. And the correct positions were the positions that Paul Ryan had. And, you know, your correct positions on taxes were this, and these are the correct positions. And he was a conservative with all the correct positions. And then the party changed. And then he tried to recorrect his positions.
Well, in a way, we're talking about ideology when we really should be talking about performance art, right? I mean, because it's, you know, he was really the first.
I don't know what he really is. I don't know what kind of conservative is he? I don't think we know anymore. Because I don't know which was the act.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I apologize to your listeners for now reducing this to, you know, performativeness, but the reality is.
Well, but that's who he was. He's always been a performer.
That's right. And now that the theatrical production seems to have changed, you know, under mm-hmm. Trump, he seems like some character wandering around on stage, you know, mm-hmm. a Rosencrantz or something, you know, wondering just what his role is.
I am jealous of your beat because you do get months of lead time of the folks running for president right now. And I put this on both sides of the aisle. Who would you want to follow for a month? And when I say follow for a month, like, get the, you know, be able to be the fly on the wall, even in the off, you know, one of those where you get to embed.
Well, probably DeSantis, you know, because I do think that, you know, DeSantis is viewed as from the Republican base.
They'd be smart to let you do this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's.
But they don't. They're so paranoid.
Yeah, I know. And I hope that.
I'm sure you've pitched this.
But I think they'll be not yet, actually, but that will be the interesting thing. I mean, I do think that there is some appetite for an alternative to Trump, even as we seem to be seeing, you know, everybody so-called come home. I'm not convinced that's utterly the case, but it's for lack of someone who presents themselves mm-hmm. as a ferocious enough alternative who can like weather the heat of Trump. And I would really like to be on the inside to see, you know, if there is much there with DeSantis. I mean, I know from people from the Freedom Caucus never envisioned him as their great, you know, philosopher king, their great warrior or anything. And for a moment in time, he clearly has benefited from a lot of traction that other people, Pence, Pompeo, and others thought that they might stand a chance of getting. And I'm not convinced that the show is over just yet, right? I'm not convinced that it's in the bag for Trump, but I would sure love to be there to see what DeSantis will do to counter those sentiments.
You know, the correct answer is it's early.
Yeah.
I know that's the correct answer.
Yeah, it is.
But there's a big part of me that thinks, oh, I think this DeSantis thing has already flamed out, but we're uncomfortable saying something flames out this early. I'm still saying, yes, it's too early. And I think I believe this, but I am wondering this. Has the political lifespan accelerated again? And we burn through people quicker now. People are in and out of politics. I mean, Beto O'Rourke's political career is over. Okay. Yeah. It began in 2018.
All right.
Okay. It is now 2023 and it's over.
Yeah.
Right? It's done. And I say this, you know, I don't know if he could win a House seat back. Maybe. You know, if it was empty or something like that. But
he's
he
a rich
would
guy.
Be,
he's got better things.
He would be like watching Charlie Crist run for Congress. Right. It was sort of like, oh, you can't give it up.
Yeah.
But it's kind of over.
Yeah.
So it's possible we just cycle through people a lot faster.
It's possible.
And I throw that out there that I wonder. And then the second thing is, this is why we have a long race. We end up finding out, oh, his fight with Disney is proof he doesn't have the temperament to be president.
I thought we had a long race to pay consultants.
You know? Well, there's that too.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I think that the open question is whether DeSantis, like a lot of these other, mm-hmm. you know, Republican pretenders, is afraid of Trump and is afraid of the MAGA movement. And
he acts like it.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
And if he is, then he will fold. He will fold sooner rather than later, maybe even in the next couple of months. He still has the opportunity to say after the legislative session, you know, I'm really, really focused on the good people of Florida. And it's, and I mean, he'll be called a coward for a week and then he can go back to his business. So we'll see after the legislative session.
You know, there's a part of me that keeps looking and watching Biden and Trump sort of default into these nominations. It's almost like we're in a Cold War. And it's a wartime atmosphere where nobody is talking about the next 30 years. We're just talking about, like, you know, they're trying to change the country. Yeah. It's a wartime. And these are two wartime generals. And wartime generals are never the most popular guys. They're the ones that are the battle tested. And in some ways, I feel like both parties are like, well, we're not running the campaign we want to run anyway. Let's go with these old generals because they've been through the fire.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's – and the through the fire in this particular case as it applies to Biden is he's already beaten Trump.
That's right.
You know, and
Trump thinks he's already beaten Biden.
That's right. He apparently does.
Yeah.
But no, I think that I mean, what remains to be seen – on the Democratic side is what's their bench after they've decided after Biden can no longer fight the war, whether he loses in 2024 or wins, you know, we'll see if Gavin Newsom or whomever else, Whitmer, you know, changes, the language or the theater of the war. There certainly is no kind of like palpable, thirsty someone on the sidelines who's even willing to test Biden, you know, for now. I mean, I've just named a couple of people who were presuming will be waiting in the wings.
You know, Gavin, I think, would have done it if he thought there was support in the mainstream of the party. And there's just not.
No.
Nobody wants to be blamed for helping Trump.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. And so, yeah.
By the way, neither does he, which is also, I think, and he's a pretty ambitious dude.
Yeah.
And, you know, even he knows when to say, maybe I'll pass up.
Well, if you're seen as the person who threw a few blows at the expense of the Democratic Party's chance to, you know, keep Trump at bay, then you have no political future. You're right.
I do feel like Gavin Newsom has, I guess I've watched a lot of Mandalorian. He's acquired a lot of armor over the years that's been through fire. And it's like the immature guy from 20 years ago. Yeah, that guy would have been a terrible national leader. It's almost like, yeah, we all had to watch him grow up in public, but boy, he's grown up into, like, it's like Jerry Brown. It's like this Jerry Brown second act. Gavin Newsom's second act might be better than we think.
We'll see. I mean, I can't pretend to be a student of Newsom, especially insofar as it would translate to the national arena. You know,
so even he will say, he does want the whole Trump thing out of the way because it is an awkward relationship that his ex-wife is with Junior. And he will...
That's Kimberly Guilfoyle.
Yeah, he will sit there and, like, even he admits, he goes, yeah, if I were you guys, I'd be obsessed with it too.
Yeah.
It's not something he loves.
No. It's, yeah, turn the page on it.
You got a book coming? You usually always
No, actually, something. This is, you know, now that I've gotten this full-time job with the New York Times, I'm pretty dedicated body and soul to the Gray Lady.
Man, you have the great gig.
It's okay.
I mean, you got to deliver every time. That's the problem.
Well, it's, I mean, half of it is magazine work. Half of it now is for the DC Bureau, the front page. But they allow me to pick my spots and allow me to, you know, take my time on it. So, yeah, I'm thankful.
Yeah. No, you have one of the envious beats. But it's always a pleasure to read you.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
It's always good to talk to you. Nice to see you.
Thanks for having me around.
You've been listening to the Chuck Toddcast from Meet the Press. Today's episode was produced by Justice Gilpin Green and Elias Miller. The theme music is composed by Spoke Media. Meet the Press Now is live every day at 4 p.m. Eastern on NBC News Now, and it is always available on demand as soon as it is done airing. Meet the Press Reports is back. That is our news magazine show. Our first episode focuses on anti-drag extremism. It'll be available Friday, May 5th on News Now and starting Saturday, anytime on Peacock. And of course, the big show's available on Sunday mornings. So don't forget that wherever you find your NBC News programming. Thanks for listening, and until we upload again.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 5. South Dakota seemed like the perfect place to unplug. But I ended up connecting to the world around me. A world where each sunset was painted. Where I felt adventures pulse with every step. And where cold water trickling, pine swaying, and grunting bison became my favorite soundtracks. I just wish I didn't have to leave. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.